Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com, that's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Welcome to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. I'm Matthew of castingacross.com, where I explore the quarry and culture of fly fishing. Your ears have found their way to my voice in the 278th episode of the podcast. And this episode of the podcast, we're talking about something that's kind of sort of still in the dead center of fly fishing, but some may consider to be on the periphery. But hear me out, I'll explain that. Well, where we are in the podcast is at the tail end of the inaugural series of Cast One podcasts. And these are podcasts that are really more oriented towards the person who's curious about fly fishing, the new fly fisher, or somebody who's interested in kind of revisiting some of the fundamentals, either for their own benefit or as they're introducing somebody else to fly fishing. And so today we're talking again about something that is important. It's not necessarily about how you go and find a fish. It's not about how you necessarily pick the fly you use when you have found that fish, or even finding the water that that fish lives in, but it is still an essential part of the picture of fly fishing. So if you imagine, you know, you're looking at a painting, you go into a portrait gallery or into an art museum, and you see this beautiful painting there, and of course there's a focus. So it's either a person, or it is a creature, or it is still life, or it is a mountain or something like that. Well, by and large, most classical artists, most people who are drawing not, you know, obscure modern art, they're going to add other things to it. Things that may not be the focus of your attention, but they really add to the richness of that painting. So whether it be the clothing that the person is wearing in the portrait, whether it be some things kind of in the foreground of the landscape you're looking at, or whether they just be little details that are fun and interesting and add some realistic perspective and flavor to that painting. And in the world of fly fishing, one of those essential flavorings, seasonings that we take in and that we actively contribute to on our way to catch fish is the culture of fly fishing. So if you know anything about Casting Across, you know that my tagline is the quarry and culture of fly fishing. The quarry is the fish. Trout, bass, whatever it might be. The culture is everything else that's around that. And this stuff is all very important. For the most kind of basic reason is that we'll just start here. Conservation. Conservation, if you haven't figured this out by now, which is totally fine if you're new, conservation, particularly the conservation of cold water resources, is an integral part of fly fishing. So another aspect that we'll kind of venture into today, more of next week, but today, that when you get involved in fly fishing, there are a couple of organizations that kind of rise to the top as far as organized coalitions that help people with fly fishing, but also have a diverse range of interests. And the most prominent one in the United States is Trout Unlimited. And if you've ever done any reading on the Trout Unlimited website, if you are a member and you get their quarterly magazine, Trout, you know that as there's a little bit of information about how to catch fish, but the majority of the information that you're taking in that they are promoting and they're trying to get you involved in is cold water conservation. Now, Trout Unlimited is certainly not the only organization that's involved in this. The Native Fish Coalition is, for example, another one that's doing some really cool, interesting work. Your local watershed may even have an organization that is specifically devoted to that watershed, the Riverkeeper Alliance. I can go on and on, and they are a variety of efforts, a variety of techniques, different emphases in the way that they communicate, how much boots on the ground they do, how much campaigning and lobbying in Washington they do. But if you want to boil it down and get rid of all that mess, conservation, taking care of the resources, is an essential aspect of the culture of fly fishing. Well, why is that? People always, I'm going to say always, but very frequently ask, why are fly fishermen so involved in conservation? And as an East Coast angler, it's very simple for me to answer that question. Because many of the watersheds, many of the famous trout rivers, many of the, even at this point, famous smallmouth rivers, have been imperiled by a number of things that have happened over the last few hundred years of our living here in the United States. And has everything to do with development and pollution. And development can take on a number of different forms, whether it be dams, whether it be channelization, whether it be the siltation that comes from things that happen upstream, or pollution. Everything from acid rain to runoff to non-point source pollutions of various kinds. And because this has happened, you have had deforested regions where there is no longer any thermal shade refuge for the streams. So these tiny creeks, they get heated up, and then there's riparian degradation. So you cut down a tree, and what happens? Now there's no longer shade for that stretch of stream, and there's no longer roots that are holding that stream bank in place. So as that river has flowed down the mountain, it has over time eroded and created a nice, deep pool, and that bank is being held in place by the root system of that tree. You cut that tree down, and over time, and immediately you lose the shade, and over time you're going to have the decomposition of those roots, and it's going to eventually cause problems with the with not just that part of the stream, but everything downstream of that. That's just one small example of how development could damage. Of course, pollution is much more extreme. We even see that today. When I was living in Pennsylvania, there was still a lot of industrial work that was done directly on top of these trout streams. And every once in a while, the wrong valve would get pulled, or there'd be a storm and water would overflow, and you'd have a significant fish kill. And again, it's not just about protecting trout, because what would die in these things? It would be more often than not the trout and the suckers and the smallmouth and the catfish and the minnows and the frogs and any sort of bird that was too close to the water when it happened. So kind of getting off on a tangent there, but this is not necessarily some tree hugging, save the whales kind of thing. This is just a common sense, hey, if we want to keep catching fish, and more importantly, if we want to be good stewards of creation and good stewards of the environmental resources that have been entrusted to us, that are in our backyards, that we recreate in, then we want to take some time to take care of it. So at the bare minimum, if you're like, I don't know, some of this stuff sounds a little bit outside of my comfort zone, or you might say, hey, you're not hitting this hard enough, I think this is more important, then my encouragement to you would be to do some research, find out what's going on, not necessarily globally, but locally. There's things that you can do across the world, but it's more important to do things in your backyard. So see what's happening locally. Figure out what some of the priorities are. Take a look at some of the different conservation organizations. See who has what priorities. See how they get their money. See how they spend their money. See how they get their workforce. See what their ultimate end game is. There's some conservation organizations that I've become more kind of interested in as the years have gone by, and some that I've kind of backed away from just because of the way they do things. And from a pragmatic perspective, it's good when good work gets done, but that doesn't mean that you have to send everybody $100 every month, and it doesn't mean that you have to have everyone's bumper sticker on your car. So that's the first, and I'm not saying most important, but one of the most important aspects of fly fishing culture is understanding that conservation has become, and again, not just on the East Coast, but across the country and certainly around the world, an integral aspect of understanding, protecting and preserving, and in many cases, restoring fisheries. Cold water, warm water, whatever. And that doesn't have to do only with making sure the water is clean. It also has to do with the fish populations and things like that. So understanding what's the role of hatcheries, what's the role of wild fish reproduction, all those things are things that are worth spending time on. Does that mean you have to get an A+ on that test before you go out and cast your first line? Absolutely not. But it is definitely something to be aware of. So that's the first thing. And again, very, very broad overview. Lots of resources out there online, certainly in Casting Across. Second thing that I wanted to talk about today is something that is very important to me. And if you spent any time on the website, you've seen this, and that is literature. Fly fishing lends itself to writing. It's contemplative. There is an experiential aspect that can be communicated in words. It is more than words in some ways, but it can adequately be described in language. And there's also a communal, again, we're talking about fly fishing, kind of culture and community. There's a communal nature to talking about what you've done. So everyone likes telling fish stories. Fly fishing has had this history of kind of refined fish stories, for a lack of a better term. And so there is a wonderful library of books out there about fly fishing. And they really run the gamut as to, well, their quality, but more importantly, they run the gamut as to their genre. And I see really kind of four main genres of fly fishing writing. There is the narrative. And so you can throw into this category famous things like A River Runs Through It or A Big Two-Hearted River or any of John Gearock's books. And if you haven't read a fly fishing book before, I would start with those three things. So Ernest Hemingway's Big Two-Hearted River, it's a short read, I think 75 pages, although I just bought a $25 copy of it. I don't know why I did that for 75 pages, but it's really pretty. Big Two-Hearted River by Ernest Hemingway. Norm MacLean's A River Run Through It. The book is better than the movie, although I will say the movie is a relatively decent adaptation. In a world where that's hard to say, I would say the movie with Brad Pitt, the Robert Redford joint, is definitely worth watching. And then thirdly, any of John Gearock's books. I mean, I don't think that there's one I like more than the other. I've read his earliest stuff from back before I was born, and I've read his most recent stuff, and I like all of it. Very casual, very fun, very funny. And so that would be a great place to start in the narrative section. The second place I would recommend, actually, so I think narratives are really important and they're a very vital part of the fly fishing culture. But the second kind of book I'd recommend is guidebooks. This is on the other end of the spectrum when it comes to kind of the nature of these books. And these books really delve into how to fish your local water. Some are as dry as dirt. I mean, you're not going to sit down and read a chapter. Others are done really, really well. And there's a number of Wilderness Adventure Press books come out. Imberfrex Books is a newer publisher that is doing some good work. Stackpole, Lions, they all have their books. But I would say find a guidebook for where you live and just browse around it. You know, keep it by your bedside, keep it, you know, in your car, flip through it every now and again. And don't just read about those streams that are 5 minutes away. Read about those streams that are really far away. It's going to create in you a sense of awareness of what's around you, but also a sense of adventure and exploration for things that are probably within a few hours drive. But I would also say too, that don't, you know, hesitate from picking something up from across the country. Like I just mentioned, the Imberfrex Books imprint, they have put out guidebooks for Texas. And I fished in Texas a long time ago, but I've had the opportunity to review these books and look at them. And it's interesting. And it makes me say, you know, next time I'm down there for business or something else, I'm absolutely bringing a fly rod. Because it's just, again, it creates a little bit of escapist excitement about the fishing opportunities that are somewhere else. And again, some of them are a little bit more dry, some of them are a little bit more exciting. But that is another kind of type of book that I think really gets you in tune with the greater fly fishing world that's around you and around the world. Thirdly is technique. This is everything from like Tom Rosenbauer's books for Orvis about fly fishing, about lefty crazed casting guides. Another good one that she just recently passed away. Kathy Beck and her husband Barry put out Fly Fishing the Flats, and this must have been in the late 80s or early 90s. But just a wonderful technical breakdown of the sport, of different aspects of it, and it may integrate narrative, it may integrate destinations, but it also kind of talks through some of the nuts and bolts of fly fishing. And in a world of YouTube, in a world of, you can pay attention, and now it's on the next thing, a book gives the opportunity to stop, reread, look at the diagram, reread the description, and go through at a slower pace. I think it's really, really quite valuable. And there's kind of a catch-all, genre of books. I think history is really important. I have a new book that I picked up that is on fly fishing memorabilia and collecting. Beautiful. It's a coffee table book. I'm excited about kind of going through it. I have another book about history of flies as they've kind of gone through the periods of fly fishing technology advancement. And so the historical kind of material aspect of fly fishing is it has plenty of books that you can hop into and read. But books are an essential aspect, I would say, of the fly fishing culture. And to a lesser degree, I would say something like Casting Across, and other websites that put forth different types of writing. I try to provide everything from, gear reviews to stories and everything in between for people to read. And so I would say that there's lots and lots of resources out there like that also. But when it comes to books, definitely go to the website castingacross.com. There is a fly fishing book section, and in it lists where I have reviewed either an entire article or just a blurb with a link to dozens and dozens of fly fishing books of all of those different subgenres. So I would definitely encourage you to check that out. Next part of fly fishing culture, it is the inverse of social media, and that is going and spending time with people. Now this is big, and for a long time this was the hub of the fly fishing world. We kind of had this we were in the fly shops, and we were on streamside pavilions with benches, and we there was even local watering holes that were frequented by anglers, and then to a certain degree also the conservation organizations and things like that, fishing clubs, fly tying groups. And then the message boards came along, which kind of allowed these groups to move and work more efficiently and raise more excitement and raise awareness and allow more people to get involved. But very quickly, we went from the message boards to social media, and everything just kind of went sideways and weird. I'm not saying there's no benefit to social media, because honestly, I mean, podcasts really kind of fall into that category. Websites that are the style of Casting Across kind of sort of fall into that category. I mean, I push all my content out on social media. I interact with a lot of listeners and readers on social media, so I can't completely speak poorly of it. But at the same time, you do miss out on that personal touch, that kind of personal touch that you had when you went into a fly shop. You would patronize that fly shop, but you'd talk to the people at that fly shop. And this is, I think, one of the things that we all need to get back to doing a lot more. It is easy to hop online and order those spools of tippet. It is easy to hop online and pick out a new rod. It is better, though, even if it costs a few more dollars. And I don't say that in the sense that money doesn't matter. But to go and foster and cultivate a relationship, not just with the guy who runs and owns the fly shop and you're patronizing his business and helping him put food on his table, but also the other folks that go in there. For many, many years, that was my primary source of information that was explicitly pertinent to where I was fishing when I was fishing. It was the big chalkboard outside the fly shop, or the whiteboard in the fly shop over the tying materials, where that talked about what the cubic foot per second flows were, that talked about what was hatching, that talked about, any other information, maybe one that had been stocked and things like that. But then you would have a conversation with the person also. Are there some crotchety, unpleasant fly shop proprietors? Of course there are. However, this is a great place to go and begin to foster and cultivate that relationship again. And there's also then the very practical aspect of it is you can get what you need where you need it. Now, I understand that not everybody lives in an area where there's one fly shop or even two fly shops. But if this is something that is where you live, then I would encourage you to be a part of it. This also can oftentimes become the hub of everything else that's going on. It can connect you to the other things that I talked about today. So the locally published or the locally appropriate books you might see there on on the bookshelf. It may be at MSRP. You could find out about it at the shop and then go to Amazon and save $3. But you could also buy it from the fly shop and have it then and there. It might even have the author come in and do a book signing and have that conversation. They're all normal people. Trust me, I've met them. The other thing is, this could be where the fly shop is raising money. There's that bucket next to the cash register where you drop your change and every dollar goes towards, stocking fish or repairing a streamside barrier. So this is the place where you can find out what's happening locally from a conservation perspective that you could potentially be a part of, whether it be, from dropping in 97 cents or it be from going and actually helping put boots on the ground and shovels in the stream bank. So the fly shop offers you that kind of connection point. A lot of them open up for fly tying nights, whether they be for classes, and we'll talk more about that next week, or just, guys to come and sit down and hang out, because there is a mutual benefit to that. People get to get together, and if people run out of hooks, guess what? They can turn around and buy new hooks from the guy. So that is, in my opinion, a kind of a three-tiered approach to fly fishing culture. Are there lots of other things? Are there fly fishing films? Yes. Are there fly fishing clubs? Of course. The fly fishing show circuit is a wintertime thing, and I think it's really important, and it's really, really helpful for anglers who are brand new and people who want to accomplish certain things. But understanding that fly fishing ought to be more than you and a rod and a fly and a trout, that there is more to it than that. And by engaging in that, I'm not saying that you have a responsibility, but you have an opportunity to be a part of something bigger. And you can really see the three-tiered nature of it, right? So in conservation, you're looking forward to the future. In the literature, a lot of times you're looking backwards. And in the fly shops and being present with other people, you're doing what's right there in front of you with the people that are with you. So it is this past, present, and future kind of way of thinking about the culture of fly fishing. And you know what? This might bring in extroverts into paying attention to other people a little more, and an introvert might bring you out of your shell. Who would have thought that fly fishing could do something like that? But the culture of fly fishing, like I said, is important to me. That's why I write so much about it over at castingacross.com. If you have any questions, if you have comments, even if you have accusations, then let me know. And actually, that's an important point. I've certainly seen an uptick in people listening over these last 8 episodes as I've talked about these Cast 1 topics. Every 10 episodes, I do a fly fishing accusations podcast. And that stems from I've been teaching for I don't know how many years, 20 plus years. And every time I end a class, I say questions, comments, or accusations. So I'm happy with questions. I'm happy with comments. And then if an accusation ever does arise, do let me know. But I usually interact with 3 of those every 10 episodes on the quote unquote air. It gives me opportunity to kind of talk about 3 things in short sequence. And that being said, anybody who gets back to me, I do my best to get back to personally, even if I don't address it on the podcast. So anything that you have questions about or comments, or even if you differ with me, I'm happy to hear it. Do let me know. All right. This week on the website, the first article is called 3 Reasons to Take a Casting Lesson, Even If You're Good. 3 reasons to take a casting lesson, even if you're good. So I kind of start this article off saying that, professional golfers have swing coaches. Professional quarterbacks who've been playing football for 20 years still show up to spring training. Spring training? I guess it's training camp because it's in the summertime. But, it just because you've been fishing for a long time and because you can get your fly where you want it doesn't mean there's not little things that you can do to get better, more efficient, and more effective with your fly cast, which can translate into being better or into doing more with less exertion, which as you get older, that's not a bad thing. And one of the ways you can get this done is through fly casting instruction. So I talk about kind of what that means. It doesn't necessarily mean going out and finding some sort of guru on a mountain who can lay out 90 feet without a false cast. But there's places you can go to get this information that is incredibly helpful. Wednesday's article was called Rusty Flybox, Staying Alive. So three articles that deal with kind of an underappreciated aspect of fly fishing, and that is health and fitness. So I have had the great displeasure as I've grown older. I think I'm the only one that's ever experienced this, where I get hurt faster and it takes me longer to recover. I had a terrible ankle injury a few years ago. I had tennis elbow one summer. Recently I did something to my back. But I have a couple articles that talk about kind of the perspective that that gives you about what you're doing now, what you were doing, what you're doing going forward. And then the third piece in there talks about just maybe it's not a bad idea to work in some extra. If fly fishing is your only thing, if you don't care about looking good, if you don't care about running a 5K, okay, fine and good. But maybe a little bit of exercise could be beneficial for your fly fishing. If that's really all you care about, hopefully you care about some more things. But that's definitely something to read if you are interested. This week's recommendation on the podcast is an incredibly handy little gadget, handmade in the United States of America by the good people at Vitavoo. It's called the Revisor, and it is a visor organizer for fly storage. So once you dive into fly fishing, you know that it is very, very possible for your flies to go everywhere, and they have a self-attaching hook that you can stick anywhere. But not every surface in the interior of your vehicle is necessarily going to respond well to that hook coming out. Enter the Revisor. So this is certainly not a new concept, but it is one that I think Vitavoo has done a good job of perfecting because of the nature of how it is applied to your visor in your car and the material it uses. It uses the hook anchor loop closure from Velcro to for you to put your flies in. And so things go in and they come out. And even if you tear it, it still allows you to put hooks into it. Only $34.95. And again, made custom order. If you have a weird size, visor, a mirror set up in your car, then I think the good people at Vitavoo would probably be able to make it work for you. So I'll put a link to the Revisor in the show notes of this podcast's page over at castingacross.com. Thanks for listening to the Casting Across Fly Fishing Podcast. Please subscribe to your favorite podcast app and rate the podcast on iTunes. Then head over to castingacross.com for 3 posts a week on the people, places, and things that go into the pursuit of fish.